I'm a hippie now.
Yeah.
How come?
Well, because you got a little ponytail. You never had that.
I do. I have a rat tail.
Is that what? Is it really? Is it only in the back that it's long?
Yeah.
Kind of gives you a certain James Hetfield quality. Hi, friends, and welcome back to Sermon Smith. This is a podcast of conversations about the craft of sermon preparation. My guest today is Phil Nellis. Phil, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm thrilled. Phil and I went to grad school together. He was a couple years ahead of me, and he is still in luscious Seattle, Washington. How are things in Seattle today?
Clear skies and sunny. A little unusual.
I don't believe
it's
you.
It's gorgeous out there.
It's only sunny in July and August from what I remember.
Yeah, I know.
So, Phil, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, specifically, you know, where you do the preaching that you do and the context you're in.
Well, I am the pastor of Wits End Church. It's a little church that got its name from Psalm 107. That phrase, Wits End, describes a state these people were at when they were at their wits' end and they cried out to God. So the church was kind of born as this an imagination of a place where people could genuinely cry out to God in a place of distress and come together and be a different kind of community. So the church itself is about 7 or coming up on 8 years old. It was begun by a another classmate of ours, Rob Gilchrist, and he was ending his time at seminary when I was beginning, and I had the honor of being one of his first interns as I was working my way through seminary. And about 5 years ago, he and his wife moved back to the Midwest and eventually ended up out on the East Coast in another ministry setting, and the church called me to pastor them in 2009. So I've been doing it coming up on 5 years.
So you're a participant in the community through your internship straight into a staff, the lead pastor role, really.
I was. And I see that as a real gift, because many, many pastors are kind of hired into church settings where they have to learn what it means to love the congregation, and I already loved the place, and it was home, and it was a pretty organic transition for me and my family.
Yeah. And what's the church look like? Like, what's the makeup? You're in North Seattle, right? Green Lake area?
North of Green Lake. So the neighborhood's called Holler Lake, and our demographic is, younger professionals, a handful of a good percentage of Seattle School of Theology and Psychology alumni, and their growing families. More and more we're having people find us that have no connection to the school, which is a lovely thing. Basement of an old Baptist church that gives us space, and we're a part of a denomination called Converge Worldwide.
And Converge is a Baptist connection, isn't it?
It is. It's a Baptist church planting network, formerly the BGC.
Got it.
Baptist General Conference.
Oh, see, I knew Converge was Baptist. I didn't know that it was Baptist General Conference.
Yep.
Okay. And then, so you meet on Sunday afternoons. Do I remember that right? Has that changed?
Yeah, we meet Sunday at 4 p.m. from 4 to 6.
Got it. And you meet every Sunday?
Every Sunday.
Yeah. So how often out of that do you do the preaching?
Well, we have kind of a monthly rhythm where I preach 2 Sundays out of the month. One Sunday out of the month, we do this thing called Midrash, where we kind of discuss a text as a community conversation. So that's a Sunday I come prepared to facilitate, but not having prepared a sermon.
Is there a particular text assigned to the conversation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's usually a midrash. It's a text from the lectionary, and it's kind of in the thread that I've chosen to follow for that season. And so I'll do all the research, if you will, on the text, and be prepared to facilitate the conversation in whatever direction it goes. but I don't come having a strong sense of what's the word from the Lord for our community. Hmm. That's something we figure out together.
Wow. So that's three Sundays. What's the fourth?
The fourth Sunday, instead of a sermon or engagement with a text, we will spend time with either a community member who is in need of prayer, or a community issue that would come around in congregational prayer.
So it's really a prayer-focused Sunday.
A prayer-focused Sunday. We'll spend a whole hour praying.
Yeah. Okay. So what do you see? Well, let's dive into this Midrash a little bit more. I had no idea you did that. So how long has that been part of the community rhythm, and what prompted that?
Well, it's been a part of the community rhythm since I started. It's something I introduced. So we've been doing about 5 years, and I'm a three-quarter time salary, and the community is always trying to figure out ways how to honor that. And that means we don't get 4 sermons a month. It means we have a pastor that is working less than 40 a week. And so part of it was just trying to honor that. And also we have a high value on conversation. And I think it comes from me really wanting to push my own ecclesiology and pneumatology to its logical conclusion. Like if we are the church, and if we are all hearing from the Spirit, then we can do this together, and we can figure out what it means to listen to a text and listen to the Spirit, and then discern a word from the Lord together.
And do you have moments, you know, Sundays that stand out that you've done that, that just felt like this, there was something significant happening in the life mm-hmm. of Wits End?
Yeah, for sure. And Sundays where the conversation begins to move in a direction where I may have concern as a pastor, but then watching the community self-correct itself
mm. yeah.
in a way that is really organic and requires a lot of trust.
Sure. Yeah. So that being said, then, what do you see as the role of preaching within Wits End? Knowing you do it twice a month, you might have a unique perspective on preaching from what pastors and a lot of other churches might. Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah, we froze one other time, but we'll keep talking through it. I was asking, okay. What do you see as the role of preaching in the life of Wits End? Because I imagine mm-hmm. the fact that you have a Midrash Sunday and a Sunday more focused on prayer, you might see preaching has a unique role from what it might have in other churches, even within Converge, sure. let alone, you know, sure. other expressions. So what do you see there?
Well, I'll start a little further back. I came to Wits End as an intern, being totally, totally over preaching. I had never been in a church where preaching was a compelling thing for me. I had never sat under a pastor for a season and felt nourished by his preaching, generally his instead of any other gender assignment. So when I came to Wits End, my mentor and the founding pastor of the community was a man whose passion and giftings were around preaching. He saw himself as a preacher, and I experienced so much nurture and care in my own spiritual life through his teaching. Hmm. And it became for me a resurrected category of, okay, so we're not totally over preaching. It was just being done so differently that it wasn't the talking head or the community expert kind of disseminating relevant information, or kind of in an authoritarian kind of way. It was rather this window into somebody's life with God that was spilling over into the community in a way that felt just absolutely beautiful to be a part of.
Yeah.
And so the church the church historically has been shaped by good preaching and has always had a value on conversation that follows preaching. And so whenever there's a sermon, there's always this thing we call faces time afterwards. We sit at tables in our church, and so the preacher will preach, someone will walk through the text, and then we get to process it a little further in smaller conversations. And this way, it's not the preacher who has the last word, but it's really the community members who get to kick it around a little further, digest it a little deeper, and take it with them.
Almost a mini midrash, really.
Mini midrash. And so when I became a pastor, I think the thing that I was least looking forward to was preaching, and that was, I found myself in a community that wanted preaching, and I had to figure out what my own voice would be in that. And so to answer your question before I kind of move in a different direction, then, our church has a high regard for it, but it's not the centerpiece of our service. The centerpiece is the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. And if we gather and there's no sermon, that's not a big deal, but we seldom gather without Eucharist.
Yeah.
And so it stands at the center, and our worship kind of leads up to it, and then the teaching conversation flows out of it. So it's often an extension of the Eucharist table.
Yeah.
That said, I also have a high regard for preaching as I'm not just offering words to consider. I do believe the word comes alive in a unique and powerful way when a community agrees to give someone's voice authority for a moment to speak into the text and guide a conversation. So it's not simply my ideas that I'm throwing out there for consideration. It's not simply interesting commentary pieces, but I'm hoping for really the gospel to be heard again for the first time.
Yeah. So an element of proclamation.
Proclamation,
yeah. So you've mentioned the lectionary. Do you use the lectionary year-round?
We do. That was one of the first things that I chose to do as a pastor, was to move us. We're a Baptist church, so we're one of the very few Baptists. I don't know of any others that use the lectionary and really follow the church calendar. That's something I fell in love with in seminary. And the lectionary does something very beautiful for me, because it puts me in conversation with many others. So often the independent church is kind of having its own conversation. But when I realized that preaching preparation could be dialogue and could be community, I got excited about preaching, and I was able to join a text study group with a number of other pastors from other traditions, spanning multiple generations. Hmm. So I'm as a new pastor, able to sit with an elderly Episcopal priest, and then a middle-aged Lutheran pastor, and we're having this conversation about texts that they've preached on a number of times, and I'm preaching on for the first time. What does it mean for each of us to enter that together? So the lectionary provides some good containment. And in terms of interpretation, any single text can be preached 1,000 different ways. And when I only have 4 texts to choose from, that's that feels really like some good containment for me.
So how do
good
you
structure?
Yeah. So how do you, how did that group form? Let me backtrack to that lectionary study group.
That had been a group that I was invited to by someone who's already in it and had been going on for years. I eventually started one in my own neighborhood to connect with other pastors nearby. So that's something I do now.
Yeah. No, that's great. When does that meet every week? How does that work?
It meets every week, and we are always discussing the text that's coming in a week and a half. So we meet on Thursday mornings, and we're not discussing this Sunday's text, but the next Sunday's text. So we're working 10 days ahead.
Yeah.
And that's kind of our cycle of preparation.
So are you only involved in, I guess you have to do it for your Midrash Sundays as well.
Yeah. I do it every week just to have a rhythm.
Yeah. Okay. Golly, there was another question I was going to ask in the midst of all that, and I've lost it. Oh, lectionary. So as you're looking at it each week, do you try to stick for a season through the New Testament passages or the Old Testament passages, or how do you select which lectionary passage or passages you're going to preach on every week?
The first couple of years I preached, I stuck strictly to the gospel readings. Kind of just as a way of really trying to understand what the lectionary is trying to do and the story that it's trying to tell. Since in the last couple of years, I've kind of opened that up to select a thread each season. So there was a Lent season that I chose to preach on the Romans thread, the epistle thread, which was Romans, which was for me was a Lenten act of repentance to deal with Paul and
you gospel lover
doesn't exist. And then there's been seasons I'll do an Isaiah thread, or the lectionary kind of does that. We'll follow a book for a season. So right now we're finishing up Lent, and I've been preaching on the Matthew thread.
And so then for Easter, you'll pick something, and then when you get an ordinary time, do you still try to continue the same thing for those 4 or 5 months, 6 months, whatever that is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, ordinary time, I have often done the Old Testament readings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's a long stint. Yeah.
And do you ever break from lectionary, or you just really want to settle into that rhythm?
I have diverted. Some weeks there's been engagement with the text that has had so much traction that to move on from it quickly doesn't feel good. And so stick it out another week in that one text and kind of skip a section. I've never diverted in terms of like choosing a topical series for a season or focus on a single book to do it kind of more in depth. Not yet. I'm not opposed to it. I just haven't gone there yet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, then let's talk about, I mean, let's, maybe you have a specific one that you've done recently in mind, or maybe, you know, maybe, just generally, but talk about what your flow looks like from, you know, working backward from Sunday at 4 PM. Mm-hmm. And it's more than a weekly rhythm because you're already starting a week and a half out, but mm-hmm. just talk through what that all looks like.
I'll start on Thursday and get to Sunday. So Thursday it begins in conversation with the other pastors that I meet with. Into the text. Obviously, the conversation has deeper roots within the season of the church calendar that we're in. And I don't do much more that week than read and listen and talk. So the text is usually begins to digest. I find that I can't do a lot of deep work with it until I have preached the sermon that's before me.
Yeah.
And so after Sunday where I preach, I will come back to the text and work with commentaries. Usually I have two chunks of time in my week where I have dedicated writing space. And for me, when I read commentaries, it's important for me to have a kind of a range of traditions and perspectives. And so what I have done historically is whenever I'm preaching on a new book, I will ask one of my biblical studies profs, Joanne Badley, usually, for her top few commentaries on that book. And I'll track those down. And for instance, I'm doing Matthew right now, and I have Davies and Ellison.
Yeah.
And then I have Stanley Hauerwas's kind of theological commentary, and a feminist companion to Matthew. And I usually try to find a few mainstream voices, and if I can, voices from minority voices from the edges. It's important for the conversation to be kind of more full in that sense.
Do you find that's easy to find that? Extra voice? Yeah, I mean, that's my experience, so...
I think I have it easier than some do, because I am nearby and connected to a seminary that values those voices, and if I'm working ahead enough, I can usually get access to a book that I need.
Yeah.
So.
Got it. Okay.
Yep.
So you'll start with the lectionary study group. Let me backtrack to that. Is there expectation for everyone coming to have done any kind of work with the text before you come?
Nope.
So you show up and read it together?
We show up, we read through all four readings, and then we usually camp out with the gospel text, and that's what most of the men and women are preaching on. And we will have conversation there. Unless there's significant traction in another one.
Okay.
Oh. And so then we all go our different ways, you know.
Do you take frantic notes on that, or do you just let it settle a little bit?
No, it's more contemplative. It's some people are taking frantic notes. I don't take frantic notes during that moment. For me, it's more letting it into my body and into my heart, and kind of hearing, getting a sense for the spirit of the text. And the questions, listening for the questions.
Yeah. Sorry, I had to mute a bit. My son has a friend over, and I'm recording from home. So they're outside. They're outside my door. So you deal with that, and that does some of your initial work with the text, but you can't really do much more. And then you said you have two blocks of time. You know, just for the purpose of context, you said you're three-quarter time. What's the rest of your time?
The rest of my time is I'm an adjunct faculty at the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology.
Yeah.
And so I do that, and there's seasons of the year that are more full than other seasons, and I'm a freelance artist.
That's what I wanted to pull out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that.
We'll talk about that. Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how I kind of pull together a living, if you will.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, because I don't know that I've ever talked to anybody who's an adjunct who says that's how they pull out a living. So,
Oh no. Every little bit helps, right?
Sure. No. So then now go into the week prior. You said you basically have two chunks of time set aside.
Yeah.
And the first one is commentary study, usually?
Usually commentary study, and work with the languages. I love working with biblical languages. I'm not very good at it. But I find the nuance of language very intriguing. My father's a linguist. That's a thing in my family, is words and other ways of saying things are full of meaning. So I like working with the languages. I use Bible Works software and a few other online resources.
What are those? I like to ask.
I usually peek at the notes from the Net Bible. I find those helpful. And Bible Hub, or what used to be Biblios. And I'm usually working out of the ESV or the NRSV. And I usually want to know how Eugene Peterson nuanced it, and find his, the spirit of his paraphrase helpful often.
Yeah. That being the message, yeah.
The message, yep.
Okay.
And usually listening to music, I have a few go-tos that really help me get in the writing zone, thinking zone.
Contemplative, like instrumental kind of stuff?
Uh-huh, instrumental.
Like what?
Explosions in the Sky.
Oh, now we're talking.
I know. We connected on that in grad school.
I'm a fan.
Texas, right? Big Skies.
Yeah, they're actually from Austin.
They are from Austin.
Yeah.
Album Leaf, and probably my most consistent one is a band called Earth.
Huh. This is new to me. Okay. You are the first person out of all of the interviews who has brought up music as being part of preparation. But
absolutely.
I find it helpful too, so I think it's great.
Well, it's partly because I'm often in coffee shops.
Yeah. So. Right.
So that helps. It helps drown everything else out.
Yeah. Okay. So most of that work you just described is really the first of your blocks. That's where you'll sit with commentaries and.
Yep.
Okay.
And then the second block is writing, and I manuscript everything I'm going to say. And then on that. If I'm on my game, if my week is going how it should go, that the writing all happens in that second block of work. And then Sunday I come to church a few hours early to set up, to fine-tune things, to connect with our ministry coordinator who's helping get everything ready. And I'll have space to say it out loud. Once or twice, and that I process verbally, and kind of what if I'm able to speak the words that are on a page out loud a few times, I have a sense of the flow and of the map that I've outlined for myself. So then I'll be up preaching, and my manuscript is something I stick to fairly closely, but it's not something I'm absolutely tied to because I know it well enough to be able to wander a little bit.
Yeah.
Here and there.
For better or for worse sometimes.
For better or for worse.
So for that first study block, usually when does that happen in the week?
That usually happens on it depends on the season, but this current season it happens on Wednesday.
And is that, are you talking 2 hours, 5 hours? What kind of a chunk of time is that?
Three or four.
And what do you hope to have accomplished by the end of that time? Obviously, you're doing a lot of reading. So are you clawing out notes in a word processing document or in a notebook? Or what do you need to feel like has been accomplished at the end of that?
Yeah, I feel like I need to have heard the voices I want to hear. The angles and perspectives. I want to have a sense for the conversation that has been happening prior to my stepping into this conversation.
Yeah.
Historically, within the Christian tradition at large, within these pockets, what's the conversation for women? What's the conversation for the privileged as Americans? Kind of those things. So I want to have a sense for what has been said, and obviously that I curate the voices I want to hear.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then, so when does that second block of time?
The second block of time is Thursday mornings, after my tech study group.
Yeah. And how long will that last then? Typically,
two to three hours, depending. If I can do it in two, good.
And is that just starting to pull everything together into a manuscript? Like that start to finish, that manuscript happens on Thursday?
It happens a little bit of both days, because that first day is also a lot of notes and summarizing ideas. And then the putting them into kind of my own words and ingesting them happens on the Thursday.
Yeah. And this is all, I asked you this, but I didn't chase down the answer. This all happen. You all, do all this on the computer, or are you a handwriter?
I do it on the computer.
So like a Word document?
Yeah, pages. A Word document.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how do you know when you're done? As you're manuscripting on Thursday, I mean, do you have particular frameworks that you try to evaluate it through, questions you ask, or is it just it's the right length? How do you feel like you know, okay, I've got this put together?
That's a great question. Some of it has to do with time constraints and energy, mm-hmm. like a sense of, I don't know that I can do much more.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know that I have space for much more. And so then trusting that it's enough. I Sabbath with my family every Friday. And so there's a sense of on Thursday, you know, getting everything in, because I'm not coming back to any email or any writing or really any kind of work related thoughts until Saturday afternoon. So there is the sense of the Sabbath is coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you start your Sabbath Thursday evening then, I assume?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you find that you're doing much change editing, tweaking to it on a Saturday afternoon, Sunday?
Well, Saturday I try not to touch it unless it's really unformed. And then I come back to it on Sunday and we'll read through it once, tweak it, and then read through it again, and then preach.
And how does it look different on Midrash weeks, all of this?
Midrash weeks are fun. I find that I don't really save any time. I'm putting about the same amount of time into it on a Midrash week, because I'm trying to anticipate the number of different conversations, directions the conversation could go. So I'm kind of making a map. Instead of when you preach, you kind of get a sense for the direction you would like the conversation to move in, and then you kind of put everything in that trajectory. When you don't know, you kind of have to map it out and be prepared for, if it goes this direction, we'll go with this. If it goes this direction, we'll go with that.
Yeah. So it's
so I
it's
I do
almost
the work
more prep.
The it can be more prep or just different prep. It uses different aspects of my intellect, my leadership. And so I welcome it as a change in rhythm. Like it's different work.
Yeah.
It's different work.
You know? Yeah, I guess when I say more prep, what I mean is it's more of the study portion, less of the manuscript portion. Because you almost need to do more of that and invite more voices, because you're going to invite then the voices of your congregation too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what do you do if nobody joins? Because there's weeks where people have very little to say or are not very engaged. And then I have to be ready to kind of move the conversation forward if needed.
Provoke it. Yeah.
Yes.
So you, as I recall, I mean, you said your dad's a linguist. You grew up in Mexico?
I did.
All of your childhood or just part of it?
All of it. I was born in Mexico City, and I lived in Oaxaca, Mexico until I was 18. My parents do Bible translation, church planning work.
Oaxaca with an X. I don't know how they get an X in there, but they do.
Yeah, O-A-X-A-C-A.
Yeah. So do you feel like you're a dual culture kid, or do you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So how do you think that, how does that shape, even that, how does that shape and affect your sermon prep? Does it just, as much as anything, answer that. I won't answer for you.
Yeah. I mean, in seminary, I went to a very conservative undergraduate Bible college.
Moody, right? As I recall.
I went to Moody, yes, and felt very limited in kind of the voices we could read. When I got to seminary and discovered the discovered liberation theology and kind of a deep tradition in Latin America for speaking on behalf of the marginalized voices and the oppressed. That resonated deeply because that was the world I grew up in.
Yeah.
Obviously, with a great deal of white privilege that worked for me in that context and also alienated me. I think my upbringing has made me more of a compassionate person and someone who listens for the cry of the poor and wants that to be heard.
Is the part of Seattle that you're in is pretty middle class? Is there much opportunity to engage there?
Yeah, it's fairly middle class where Width End is. Up until January of this year, my family lived nearby, and we had an unexpected move in January where we had to move further away, and we now live in the Latino neighborhood, White Center, Del Ridge area. And so I'm enjoying being closer to my roots in that sense, but also trying to figure out what it means to pastor from a little further distance.
Yeah.
It's a challenge.
So let's talk about your art then.
Mm-hmm.
You're a working artist, as you said it. How do you see an interplay between the work you do? You do painting, right?
Primarily illustration or design.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of interplay do you see between the work you do as an artist and sermon preparation?
The work, I don't know that there's much interplay or as much as I would like there to be. I see my work as a preacher very much through the lens of an artist that I like kind of Friedrich Buchner's approach to sermons that feel like poetry, they feel like stories. And I pay attention to repetition and drama in how I craft ideas and communicate them. And I think that's a way that I am, that my identity as an artist spills into my identity as a pastor. But in terms of the preaching itself, I don't do anything visual when I preach. I don't paint and talk.
Sure,
that kind of thing. I do pay attention to the aesthetics of our space. I mean, we're in a Baptist church basement, so it's everything you can imagine it is.
Are there fake flowers?
When we got there, I'm sure there were. We do everything we can to make sure that the space itself is hospitable and aesthetically kind of conducive to worship in that sense.
Yeah. I didn't imagine that you painted while you talked or anything like that.
No.
I was just curious if you feel like there's any disciplines that you have to go through or practices you have to go through as an artist that you see parallel with as you're crafting mm-hmm. sermons, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think some of the discipline I have cultivated as an artist has definitely shaped my work as a preacher, for sure. The disciplines of kind of the war of art in forgetting the author of that
Stephen Pressfield.
Stephen Pressfield's little book.
Yeah.
Just the work of showing up and putting in your time, just like the faithfulness of the work is a big part of it. Other than that, I think some of those things run so deep that it's difficult to pull them out and put words to them. They're just,
yeah,
they're just kind of how I breathe.
Yeah. You mentioned Buechner. Which do you recall a Buechner book where that you read some of that?
Is it the sermon on Isaac in the Hungering Dark? Is that?
I've only read a little bit of Buechner, so.
Yeah, he has multiple volumes of sermons that are just wonderful to read. But the one where Abraham is sacrificing Isaac is one that's memorable to me.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to track that down because that sounds like that's worth reading. So, do you do other work besides? Is most of your sermon prep happen in those windows of time? You know, do you do? I mean, we talked earlier before we started recording about how you were a research assistant on a book, you know, back when you were finishing grad school and all that. So obviously you have habits of research and accumulation. Do you do much of that on an ongoing basis now? I mean, do you do a lot of reading outside sermon preparation, and do you try to capture any of the things as you're reading and tuck them away for later or anything like that?
I think so. I'm always trying to read a novel. I'm always trying to read some sort of book on ecology. And those definitely shape how I think. My family does a fair bit of the urban farm lifestyle. And we do gardening and have had chickens in the past and bees and the more I feel like the more I read in that world of kind of homesteading, the more I understand the agrarian core of what Jesus' metaphors are in the Gospels. But in terms of I'm not a voracious reader, and so I don't read much outside of the reading I'm doing for sermon preps and for teaching my classes and for leisure.
Yeah.
But I am a collector in terms of what gets filed away in my memory. And I don't have notes everywhere. I don't write things down.
Yeah. I'm pretty crazy about trying to capture notes and underlines from books, but I find more often than not, it's not that I return to them that much. It's still the stuff that's generated by my memory that gets used.
Well, I saw you had a field note pen that you're using. What's their tagline?
I'm
not writing it down to remember it later. I'm writing it down to remember it now.
Something like that. Yeah.
Or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I do like my field notes. Wow, is the resolution that good? You can make up a pen?
Not bad.
And then do you do any sort of process after the fact for reviewing your sermons?
Yes. Well, we record my sermons, and our church puts them on our website. I'm saying it like it's an abstraction. Nikki puts it on our website, bless her heart. And we don't do any editing. We just kind of maybe clip it at the beginning and at the end. And so sound is what it is, and you get what you pay for. But that's a way of capturing it. And there's been a number of times that I go kind of just go back and listen to that and kind of hear and reflect on the experience of speaking it and then reviewing it. I process, my community loves to process the hell out of everything. So there's most weeks I have at least one, two or three conversations with parishioners about the sermon and the conversation that led to for them. So that's I think more what I'm interested in, just where the conversation went to or how it has stayed alive in the community in the weeks that follow.
Yeah. Are you often surprised by where it goes?
Oh yeah, yeah. Those invisible lines of connection, like the Spirit of God is doing something in this corner, and then I, without knowing, participate and have like my contribution in the deep work that God is doing over here, and that was exactly what that person had been working with, and or whatever. It's just, it's magical.
Yeah. So what then are, what then would you say, I'm jumping around here, because questions come to mind about other questions I've already asked, but are there, you know, as you talk about trying to find other voices and all that, have you found there's a few good resources, or do you have any go-to resources almost every time that you try to go to, other than asking Joanne badly? What commentaries should I get? But do you have some key resources that you like to use?
Well, my other key resource is Matthew Shedden. I'm not somebody who is up to date on new books, and so I have the people I go to. If I'm looking for new novels, I know to go to Scott Small. If I'm looking for new commentaries, I know to go to Matt Shedden. People like that.
Fellow students. I guess I could say that either way.
Yeah, current alumni, colleagues, current colleagues, really now. I usually want to hear what Walter Brueggemann says on a text if it's an Old Testament passage. So I do have a few go-to people that I'm like, if I'm preaching Palm Sunday, I really wanted to know what N.T. Wright has said about Palm Sunday.
Yeah.
So.
Sure. And then are there books, you mentioned The War of Art, specifically about art, and you mentioned, you know, Buechner's sermons, but are there books that you feel like have formed you in terms of how you preach? They might be preaching books, they might not be preaching books.
Yeah, I haven't read any preaching books.
That doesn't surprise me.
I mean, the ones that come to mind are Annie Dillard's Holy the Firm. Like, I read that probably once a year. Hmm. And the way Flannery O'Connor tells stories is deeply moving to me.
What is it about O'Connor that strikes you? Because hope is very veiled in the Flannery O'Connor that I've read.
Oh, yes, yes. I think it's the abruptness of truth. Huh. And kind of grace being this thing that is absolutely disorienting and unnerving. That's what I love about how she tells stories.
Yeah. Okay, Flannery O'Connor. Are there others?
Wendell Berry, for sure.
A standout of any of his? I need to read more Barry. I've only read a bit.
I read his poems often. I have a collection of his Sabbath poems called Timbered Choir that I return to often. Any of his essays from the kind of the late 80s, early 90s, he was on fire then. That's kind of what comes to mind right now.
That's fair.
I'm reading, I just finished a book about crows. And I'm reading a book about death right now. Kind of more ecological pieces, but they connect up. They connect up.
You find you're referencing them often.
Yeah, yeah. And books about food. Tamar Adler's Everlasting Meal was a big book for me last year.
I haven't heard of that one.
Amazing book, yeah.
Tamar, like T-A-M-A-R?
Yep.
Interesting. Okay.
Adler.
So you've beaten off the Michael Pollan, Mark Bittman path of food books to the mainstream food books. You've found your way into...
Yeah, I like
fringe.
Michael Pollan, but... Yeah, he's definitely mainstream for sure.
You've gotten to the fringe voices even in your food reading.
I don't know about that, but yeah.
Got it. All right. Backtrack one more question I have, and we'll start winding down because we're getting to our normal time. But
all right.
You mentioned Bible Works. Do you mostly do that just for language study? Are there other things that you like about... I'm surprised how many people use so many different Bible apps. So curious what it is about Bible Works, how you got into that one, and what you enjoy about it.
I think it's just the one I got into in seminary because I couldn't afford Logos.
Yeah.
And it's the one I've learned how to use. Some of these things are clunky enough that if you figure out how to use one of them... I'm not very... tech savvy, and I'm definitely not a computer geek. So that's kind of just the old tool that's in the toolbox kind of thing.
And is it primarily then you use it for language word study kind of work?
Yeah, language work. Yeah,
got it. Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you about how you particularly prepare for sermons that you think would be interesting to add to this conversation?
We definitely covered a lot of it. The piece about our community that feels somewhat connected is we're a smallish church with lots of children. So about a third of us are kiddos. And so, I mean, a lot of my work as a pastor has been to help our community develop a children's ministry that has the same values that we have for ourselves as adults in terms of how we hear, how we regard the text, and how we listen for the Spirit.
Yeah.
And so we've, over the years, worked to develop a Godly Play program that we've kind of made our own. I don't know if you're familiar with Godly Play.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a Montessori-based Episcopal curriculum that works well with the church calendar, but has a way of telling stories that is so not about the moral of the story. It's about the story stands up on its own two feet. And the children then have a time of wondering. So it's not that we're trying to teach them something. It's that we're trying to get them to ask their own questions. And then there's this. So there's story, there's wonder, and then there's creative response. The kids get to do art in response to the story and the questions they have. And so when we found that model of children's education for the church, we realized that's what we're already doing in big church, if you will.
Yeah.
Like there's preaching, but it's not moralizing. It's there's very seldom a takeaway. It's more, I'm far more concerned with us leaving with better questions and more curiosity. And so if my preaching can stimulate wonder and disrupt us to kind of ask the questions we're afraid to ask, or to lean into each other's questions in ways that strengthen the community. That's where our stories as human beings collide with the story of God. And that's what I get excited about in terms of the possibility that emerges with preaching.
Yeah. Well, great.
Yeah.
You're the first one to mention music, and now you're the first one to mention kids. Well done.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. Kids are a big part of things over here.
They are. Well, and we're kind of in the same boat. I mean, we have a ton of kids, too, and they're part of our liturgy for part of it, so they're all over the place. So
yes, they are.
Well, if somebody wants to keep up with what's happening with Phil Nellis, personal blog, church website, are you tweeting? You still tweet. You don't tweet anymore. I think I follow you. Yeah.
For a while, I think my blog did automatic links to Twitter, but...
Well, there you go.
I don't tweet.
So your blog, then, and the church website, what are those?
Yeah. Yep. And I can send you the links to those.
Yeah. All right. So we'll put the link to your blog and to Whitson Church on the show notes here.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, thanks, Phil.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. This was a really provoking experience. I think it's good to put words to the things that are always there.
Yeah, your own processes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's been my pleasure. I've loved chatting with you.
Thank you.